Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. I am the Director of Digital Services here at Eastwick Communications. Every week, we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. Today, on this cool but not too cool Bay Area day, I have the pleasure of welcoming friend of Eastwick, Sam Whitmore, of the eponymously named Sam Whitmore's Media Survey. How are you, Sam?
Great, Jennifer. It's great to be here. Thank you.
You know, I realized today when I was soliciting Twitter questions that we both hail from the East Bay. So I am in Castro Valley. I'm not sure where you are in the East Bay, but we're probably in the same place a lot of the time.
Pretty close, yeah. we live in Oakland, just off of 580, and we live up on the hillside there. It's very nice.
Yes, it is. We're in the hills as well. So without talking too much about location and making all the others that are in colder climates feel bad, without further ado, let's talk about your media survey. For those that don't know, can you tell us what it is, and for those that of us that do know, how it came about?
Briefly, it's a service that my wife and I provide. And we provide it to PR pros who would like to increase the odds of success when pitching tech reporters, tech bloggers, anybody who's an influencer. And what we do is analyze what's published. We do reverse engineering of the stories that make it. And we do a very granular analysis of why publications and bloggers behave the way they do, why they make the choices they make. Most PR people work with messages, they refine the message, and then they go shop the message. We do it from the other direction. We look at what made it all the way through and made it to print or made it online, and we just work back from there. And that sort of exercise for 11 years now has helped tech PR pros pitch more successfully.
And, you know, we can obviously, we're big fans of yours. I said on our blog that there's rarely people that I say I have, you know, sort of professional affection for. You're one of those people because you do make a big difference, and I think you provide a nice reality check for us. But, you know, one thing I wonder is, you know, kind of popping up a level is, what made you come to the conclusion that this is what you wanted to do, and that, you know, how did it grow as a business?
It was quite by accident. I quit Ziff Davis angrily in the spring of 1998. I had absolutely no desire to do anything but work at Ziff Davis as an editor and as a business developer at that time. And we had a church-state issue. They wanted me to do something that I didn't believe I should do ethically, and they forced my hand, and I quit. And I started Media Survey, and I'm still doing it. That's how it came about. As far as the nature of the service, when I ran what's now defunct, it's PC Week, the publication that's now eWeek, but I ran that for a long time, and I did a lot of competitive analysis editorially on how we compared against Computer World, Information Week, and Network World, and would analyze in a very granular way our reviews or in our narratives, whether our anecdotes were better, whom did we quote, who did they quote. And I just took that formula and point of view and turned it into a service that PR people could use to get more empathy for how editorial gets created, why it's created the way it's created, and by helping PR people understand the edit part of the equation better, we've been able to win a following in the tech PR business, and I'm very grateful for that.
Yeah, actually, your leaving Ziff Davis reminds me of the CNET editor that left. It actually wasn't CNET. It was for, I believe, one of their gaming divisions. So not, I want to say GameSpy, but there, anyway, there was some, you know, question about whether he wouldn't write, or he wrote something that wasn't positive, and there was a, you know, an advertiser involved. And that person quit, and then there was sort of a domino effect of other people that left that gaming publication, an online publication, and it reminds me of that. And it happens more than people think. I think you're not alone. Those of us that, like myself, have left the media industry all have our different reasons, but a lot of it comes through going through some sort of painful process to get to where we realize, wow, we've developed some sort of skill that maybe we can replicate in a different environment. So it's really interesting. I think one of the things that, you know, we do, as you know, as an agency, is instead of looking at message, look at story. So from my perspective, working in social media, I've completely drank the Kool-Aid. I was at a business pitch yesterday morning, you know, extolling the virtues of our agency, because it's a lot easier as a social media person to have this deep message to then, you know, be able to kind of pick and choose smaller pieces of to push out through various social media channels, whatever the hot tools are at the moment. But as a strategy, it is, to me, the one thing that really makes this an integrated social media effort, right, is that, you know, the story is the common theme. What I love is one of the first times I met you, you talked a little bit about, I think, some of the archetypes that are popular in terms of, you know, the way people write. Can you talk a little, I don't want you to give trade secrets away, but a little bit about getting into the mindset of a writer, because I think you and I probably are there, but not everybody realizes not only do writers kind of write in these archetypes that we recognize, and so we recognize them from maybe childhood and the way stories develop, David and Goliath maybe being one of them. And then there's also that part, you know, so they recognize them and maybe that's why they resonate more. So, you know, and then why reporters might choose, why they might like a particular way of writing, or identifying how they are more likely to write a David and Goliath story than a different other kind of story. So, you know, kind of getting into the idea of the methodology of that goes into story writing.
Well, sure. I'll keep it to two story types so as not to ramble on, but I think we should preface that by saying that the opportunity for telling stories now in the media is shrinking, in part because of business considerations in the media environment, but also because people's attention span is so compressed now in this Twitch generation that it's getting ever more difficult to get someone to sit down and read a 1,500-word piece, even if it's beautifully illustrated, even if it has a slideshow on the website and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly, people are consuming their media on iPhones and Blackberries, and while they're doing something else, while they're listening to music, and there's such a competition for attention. That's what I worry about the most for the future of telling stories. It's not that writers don't want to write them anymore. They do. I just worry about people's ability to consume these stories the way that it's always been done. But what are these stories? Well, there's the two most common patterns that when we analyze tech editorial, we see, number one, the story, can they do it? You almost always see, like, a favorite punctuation mark for business editors is the question mark. Can they do it? Like the unresolved conflict. And if you analyze, can the company do it? The company used to make their money this way. Now they're making it this way. Can they do it? Or the executive that was fired 2 years ago from such and such, now they're over here. Can they vindicate themselves? Can they do it? And that formula can be transplanted into nearly any opportunity that a PR agency can identify, as long as you have a compelling enough human actor. I once asked Bruce Upton at Forbes, what are the reasons where you approve a story, the writer starts to report it, then they turn in the first draft, and you say, you know what, we're spiking this story, it's just not there. What are the reasons that that would happen? And he said the number one most common reason is lack of a strong human actor, because most stories need to have a face on them.
Mm.
Because in a magazine framework that people really want to see themselves in the stories that they're reading. That's why they're reading them. It's a very personal experience. So that's the number one, can they do it? The other thing that I've seen more and more is the rugged individualist, the person the person who is against the grain within their own company. Like, for example, Adam Leshinsky profiled the cost cutter that Google just brought in. There's no bigger largesse manufacturer in Silicon Valley than Google, with their chefs and the free butter and massages and things. So they just brought in a cost cutter. Like, no one wants to talk to the cost cutter, but he has a job to do. So that's a good profile against the grain. Now, also, companies are against the grain, too. I mean, probably the best known is Mark Benioff and Salesforce, not because he himself is an iconoclast, but also because he is sort of the reigning champion of software as a service, which subverts a lot of the traditional business models in software. So people love Benioff, not because necessarily he's quotable, although he certainly is, but because he's a rugged individualist who has succeeded in going his own way. And those two themes are evergreen, and they probably always will be. So to finish this soliloquy here, the thing is that when PR agencies are sitting down with their clients and ruminating about what it is that they could probably shop to the media, instead of starting with key messages, perhaps you should start with the kinds of stories that the media consistently writes, and consider them sort of molds or buckets into which you would insert the details. So then when you pitch, you can say, you know, this story that you did on this rugged individualist, well, really, it's the same sort of story, except the details are a little different. Here's our human actor. And so you can use the past behavior of these publications to your advantage, because they've already run things, and you're just reminding them that they've already run this kind of a story. So where would your objection be if you were to run this kind of a story, except with different detail? So that's the kind of thing that we do at Media Survey. We reverse engineer things that have already been done and then present them in a context that you can use.
And as someone who's been in the position, in editorial positions over the years, how do you think writers come to, you know, it seems like a lot of writers do tend to have favorite ways of writing. I certainly do. You know, how do you look at that piece and potentially advise clients about, you know, oh, that, you know, this particular reporter really likes to write this type of story. You know, is there, you know, how often are you looking at that? How often does it change, or do you find it a prevalent trend?
I find it harder to find a voice in mainstream media writers more and more, because the formula seems to come down from on high, either from the copy desk or from very senior editors that want to deliver a particular kind of product. Very much the way that that record companies want to produce certain artists that sing a certain way and play a certain way, it's a product.
Right.
So the extent to which, like a Business Week story, I mean, you tell me if you can find voices in the magazine articles. I can't. Now, in the blogs, that's a different story, because that's purer. You know, the people sit down and blog, and out it goes.
Right.
So there's much more voice in blogs and sort of the dynamic content, as opposed to the packages that the mainstream media publications like to put out. So,
and I think that's particularly true probably in the technology and business press, which is what you're really specifically analyzing, right?
Yeah, I specialize in that.
Because, I mean, I think, you know, you can say there's a voice with certainly Christopher Hitchens, who writes for Vanity Fair, and you can, you know, look at certain high-profile writers who are also book authors, and they have the ability to create a voice. But I think, you know, looking at, you know, journalism school graduates right now, and, you know, this surge actually in applications. I had Sri Srivanathan from Columbia on, who happens to be dean of students, used to be tech reporter for ABC7 for many years, and then at NBC in New York City. And he was, you know, he was noting that the trend is happening at Columbia as well. So, you know, we're looking at the trend going, you know, gosh, what are people looking for? And, you know, increasingly they're looking for basically digital education. So there's this entirely different debate about, you know, from us alums about how well Columbia really did equip us for kind of a more technical world than writing and reporting used to be. So I think that's kind of interesting. I was going to ask you, too, Jeremiah Owang this week has been at a conference in Amsterdam. And, you know, when we talk about writing, we can't help, especially when writing is dictated from on high, as you succinctly said, you know, the demographic factor, it's a huge one. You know, what I wonder is, you know, between Generation X and Generation Y, you know, who are most publications in the technology and business sector focusing on? Because I think part of that is muddling the message, right? Because the millennial generation, those born after 1982, are those that I think have more of attention span problem than even Generation X, which attention span issues based on MTV, the, you know, arriving on the scene have been well noted. But one quote that Jeremiah had on his blog this week was that by age 20, kids will have spent 20,000 hours online, the same amount of time a professional piano player would have spent practicing. So, I mean, I think I'd rather be a great piano player or the best that I can possibly be than be online. But, you know, being online is our life. So in terms of demographics, do you think maybe trying to get to too many pockets of generations is part of muddling the message right now?
Well, let's break it down by segment. The Wall Street Journals and the Forbes and Business Weeks and people like that are straddling two generations, but primarily they want tomorrow's leaders. And they struggle because of their lead time, because of their dependency on print and their lead times, they are struggling to provide some sort of pathing for the upwardly mobile publishing executive. Those people are generally the last people that are going to sit down and read something that they don't absolutely have to read.
Mm.
So what typically happens is they may lean more toward people in their 50s who are worried about their retirement or aging out of an organization. And so there's this battle when they're shaping what do we put on the cover and what kinds of stories should we be writing these days. They battle between the upwardly mobile person who represents tomorrow and the group that probably is actually going to read the article, which is people that are sort of going out the other end of the pipeline toward retirement. I think it might help PR people to understand the very basic philosophies of these publications. Like, for example, Fortune. They are about power, power and the powerful. Anything pitched to Fortune has to have some sort of backdrop of power, political power, economic power. It's a hierarchically minded operation. Forbes is about wealth. And I happen to know that from the inside because I did a column for Forbes.com for a couple of years back in this decade. And Paul Maidman, the editor there, always used to say, every Forbes story is designed to make you either smarter or richer. Every pitch that is sent in to Forbes should somehow refer to that. And it's shorthand, and it's not really in any of the mastheads. It's not even in, I suppose you could find it in the literature if you wanted to look at the media kit. But very few PR people take those sorts of factors into account. And when it comes time for the senior editors to sit around with the deputy editors and say, what are we going to prioritize here, and what aren't we, it really boils down to those philosophical questions. The Economist cares about capitalism. They don't care about politics. They don't care about anything but perpetuating the belief that capitalism solves all problems. And so to pitch The Economist, it's good to have that in background, because the senior editors will say, hey, these people really understand what makes us tick.
Mm.
So maybe one PR person in 10, 20, 50, I don't know, will bake that in, but we strongly advise it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the interesting things, too, is that, you know, all of these publications are, you know, working, some now only in new media, or basically web-based media, social media, using these channels to get information out. But what I'm wondering is who you think has done a good job bridging traditional media with new media. And I know you're going to say Business Week, right?
Yeah, I would have no choice but to say that.
But why do you think that is?
Well, because they want to work from the readership back toward themselves. They have done a huge job over the last 12 months of crowdsourcing their thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And they have one story a week that comes from a reader. In many cases, it's one of the most popular stories that runs on businessweek.com, and they publicize it. John Byrne has bet the farm on engagement,
mm-hmm,
as a criterion for placing advertising. Now, he's not the publisher, but he has a great chance of going to the 28-year-old media planner at an ad agency and say, we are truly differentiated from everybody else because we are leveraging the expertise of our readership, and we can also prove that an engaged reader on the edit side is an engaged reader on the advertising side, and don't you want to have your messages in an environment where readers are provably engaged and passionate about what it is that they're seeing there. So
mm-hmm,
no one else is really doing that as well as Business Week is. Now, Fast Company really had the edge there with Company of Friends, which they had for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And they, in my opinion, have bobbled the ball in migrating into the social media world. Some of it is a technical reason. Their website is dog slow. It's dog slow. It's, I don't know what happened, but they did a site redo maybe 12 to 18 months ago, and they went to an open source platform, and the user experience of getting to that site and fishing through the blogs and, you know, the navigation's an issue. So one of the barriers to mainstream media bridging the gap, which was your question, is that the publishing companies really have to be good software companies too. They have to, if they can't write the code themselves, then they have to bring in contractors that really know how to optimize the reading experience and increasingly the viewing experience as a lot of these publications move to video.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not the skill that they have. The skill that they have is cutting down trees and trucking magazines around and writing clever cover lines and being on the top of the mountain and have everybody kissing their butt. And that era has passed. They have to be software companies now. So companies like Omniture and WordPress, I mean, those are the people that have the right skills to be successful in this decade and in the next one in terms of publishing. So those are really the only two publications that I even care to mention as far as being able to bridge the gap.
So one of the areas that you mentioned and touched on was, of course, rich media, and rich media usually means video. And Fortune seems to be a place we are reaching out more and more to through their video network. Do you see video as maybe a backdoor way to potentially get into these places, or as a premium way for... Or do you, I'm sorry, I guess I should approach it the other way. Publications, do you think they're looking at it more from the perspective of, we need to get rich media out there, let's go find these stories, and they're more susceptible to accepting pitches that they might not for print? Or is it more of a, opportunity to get sponsored content on the site? Because I've seen both, so Information Week has sort of the sponsored model, but Fortune doesn't, if we take those two examples.
Well, sponsored content, there's advertorial sponsored content, and then there's editorial sponsored content. Fortune, for example, has a clean green video series, and it's sponsored by IBM, and it's hands-off. It's a hands-off sponsorship.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what's coming before it's coming, and they just want to be around that. That's the traditional way to sell advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's all these gradations, shades of gray in the trades. Some trades do have hands-off type sponsorships, but most don't. Most, they want to know, if not the exact name of the segment and all that, they certainly don't want to sponsor something that's going to mention an advertiser. I mean, not an advertiser, a competitor.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of a minefield for PR, because let's say Oracle wants to sponsor something on news.com or ZDNet or something like that on a particular video thing. And if you're representing IBM or some Oracle competitor, who isn't? Everybody competes with them somewhere. Then you might run into a situation where it's still sort of officially speaking editorial, but the producer now suddenly doesn't really want to talk to you anymore. There's a lot of that going on. There's a lot of fear. There's so much advertising industry consolidation. There's so few advertisers now that there's a lot of self-censorship going on, irrespective of what the traditional church-state roles are. And the editors and producers, particularly video producers, are leery of getting in hot water or finding themselves in a meeting they really don't want to be in.
Mm.
So that leaves PR people sort of in the dark, and that I worry about that. I mean, personally, I think that that vendors ought to be doing their own video, but they should be publishing it themselves and
mm-hmm.
search engine optimizing it so it shows up on Blinks and all these other new search engines, and
mm-hmm.
Or taking advantage, especially if they're startups, let's say, of TechCrunch's elevator pitches.
Mm-hmm.
You heard of those? They're just,
oh, yeah, they're great.
Yeah, they're super good, and it's self-serve. It's self-serve coverage.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is one area where I wanted to ask you kind of the tricky question, because I come from the TV world, and I interviewed a few weeks ago Spencer Christian, who's a friend of mine over at ABC7, and you know, doing the lifestyle show A View from the Bay, they do you know, a little bit more high level, you know, what is Twitter kinds of stories. But, you know, what I was asking him is, you know, sort of the general question is, you know, with the demise of the newspaper and the rise of rich media being sort of the premium media for a lot of, you know, the target segments that people or, you know, advertisers might be trying to get to, especially as advertising is fading, does TV have an advantage? And that's what I really wonder, and, you know, wonder if you've thought about that or talk about that or have analyzed that at all.
Does it have an advantage in what way?
In the sense that, you know, if you look at online media, or you know, there's a premium on video. People seem to like it. If you have sharing features, bloggers will embed it on their blog, so there's the viral element. There's a lot of advantages to doing video if you do it right. And I'm just wondering, because broadcast has been doing video online longer, if you see them having an advantage over Fortune and others who are trying to kind of get into the video game late in terms of just eyeballs.
Well,
so if
for pure consumer purposes, yeah, because television has decades of experience in reducing the appeal of a particular segment to the broadest possible group. That's sort of the positive way to say it. And the lowest common denominator is the more pejorative way to say it. But that's what they're in. They're into scale. Television is a scale business.
Mm-hmm.
And publications are actually exclusive media in the strictest sense of the word. They want to exclude most of the people, and by excluding everybody else, the people that are left are the affinity group. And this
mm-hmm.
is what I was saying earlier about the wealth levers of Forbes or Fortune and so forth. So as they go to video, they're over a barrel because their cultural DNA is to appeal in sort of a snobby way to people that could really appreciate the ingenuity of this segment. And television is in some ways totally service journalism based now. And that's why it's interesting to see the publishers wrestle with this conundrum of how do we get broad enough numbers to attract advertisers without going out with a segment that tells these professionals the sky is blue.
Mm-hmm.
The water is wet. And yeah, we know that. Tell us something we don't know. We're used to being paid a lot for our time. Our time is more valuable than the consumer's time. So that's the issue. And so to answer your question specifically, TV has an advantage if you're talking about broad, accessible points, such as new imaginative things you can get for your dad on Father's Day. Everybody had a father at some point.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I mean by reach. But if it were, now that sharper image is gone, what do you get for the unpleasable, right, that sort of father, that's the sort of thing that you could get Fortune to do, and it would probably click like crazy.
Yeah, you would think. Well, we're at about the halfway point, so I just want to thank those that are joining us and welcome you to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay of Eastwick Communication. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick, and this week I'm chatting with Sam Whitmore of Sam Whitmore's Media Survey. So I wanted to change gears a little bit and talk about influence, something that really this show is inspired by, and of course is a huge project for us at Eastwick, as you know, ongoing influence mapping, charting, figuring out where it lies. Is it in the online world? Is it in the offline world? Is it word of mouth? Can it be inspired by viral techniques? So who are the most influential titles in tech publishing?
By what measure? Do they sell products? Do they accelerate investment?
Let's say, you know, well, first of all, who's got increasing circulation rather than dying circulation? So that's one way to look at it. You know, so who's actually reaching people, whether it's online or offline, or both? And then two, you know, potentially getting people, giving them a better understanding of, you know, garnering leads or meeting specific business objectives.
Well, I'll answer the first part having to do with print publication circulation, but honestly, you know, I think people should stop talking about print, frankly. But circulation-wise, Fast Company did great last year. It was up something like 30%. But you could count on one hand everybody that went up. Wired went up in circ a little bit. The Economist does great here. In fact, UK media in general, the FT went up this year here. The BBC is a big force here. I think the election and people's sort of collective distrust here in America of American media that sort of forced them to go out and have to learn about their own country from someone else. And I think collectively that really benefited FT, The Economist, BBC, to name three. So those publications and titles and brands, we really should call them brands because they have live events and they have websites and newsletters and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's sort of the broad brush. In terms of our little neighborhood here in tech, Silicon Valley, TechCrunch continues to cast a spell over over the valley and startups. And it has done so in spite of a very checkered track record of accuracy and as far as, like, literally would their practices stand up in the eyes of Columbia Journalism Review or any of those sorts of things? Probably not. People don't seem to mind. And I think it's because they're in the entertainment business. Mike Arrington knows that. It's sort of infotainment. And it's a couple of steps, sort of with a little bit more integrity than a valley wag, but it's got the sensibility of candy, and I wanna see what they're up to. And nobody else has really achieved that.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of interesting because, you know, I'm 52 years old. I believe in having three sources for stories and having fact checkers and. And I just feel like an anachronism. I don't think people really care about that anymore. Not enough people care about it. And so that's fine. You know, that's okay.
Mm.
That's okay. Maybe it was never right to feel that way. But I think that I watched TechCrunch and its popularity with that sort of lens. It's like that seems to be what everybody's cool with, so that's okay, you know.
I mean, it seems like there would be a few others so let's look at the online space. If we're talking about, you know, kind of who's web ranking well or ranking well on the web in terms of, unique page views, TechCrunch would be right up there. Who else is influential from that perspective, eyeballs?
Well, they only have a million. They only have a million uniques. It's actually not that high, but it consistently grows. You know who has a lot of traffic, and you never really realize it is PC World.
Mm-hmm.
PC World has a lot of traffic. News.com does very, very well. Ars Technica has filled the gap in a lot of ways for people that really wanted a real technical appreciation. In spite of, the blogs like Engadget and Gizmodo, those sort of people really hurt the magazine websites. But Ars Technica has thrived, I think, in many cases because they just have better technical chops than a lot of these bloggers. A lot of the bloggers are just simply, that's probably an overstatement. But some of the mediocre blogs tend to just be distribution arms, or just give me something new and I'll write 125 bland words about it, or maybe something cute, and just give me a big photo, give me a high-res photo, and that sort of passes for analysis. So Ars Technica has found a role serving people who want more than that. I think that's really good for them.
That's interesting. Because I wouldn't have thought of them in this sort of same league. PC World is a funny one for me because I came home one day. It was actually the day that it was announced PC World's magazine was no longer going to exist. And my husband was talking about subscribing to it. I think I should subscribe to this. And I was like, well, honey, I think you missed the boat on that one. You like RSS feeds? So, and he's not an RSS guy, so it's interesting to kind of watch his user behavior as well. So in terms of influence, you know, that seemed to be a word that kind of catches you in some way that, you know, might be an interesting area for us to just explore for a second. How do you define influence when people ask you questions like I just did? Who's the most influential at this? Because, you know, PR communications, we're trying to basically capture these influencers, cast a spell on them with our clients, and, you know, indoctrinate them enough to get them to write or to broadcast something about our clients.
Mm-hmm. Well, I always gravitate toward segmenting it, segmenting influence. For example, some people want to be in environments where there's a purchase involved and there's a buying decision that is close to being made. So in that area, I think the consumerist is big. That's why Consumer Reports bought them, or PC World and CNET are clubbing each other over the head to build transactional content to provide as much information as they can so that they whet people's appetites and they'll buy a product right there on the site and get a commission on it. That's
mm-hmm.
a particular kind of influence. And there are also new social media-driven companies like Bazaar Voice, for example, that produce that sort of social commerce content under contract. And I think we should note that now in the call that we've been talking about media brands as we've always known them. But
mm-hmm.
there are new companies that are harnessing underemployed people, unemployed people who have passion and expertise about things, and aggregating those people in a loose confederation, a network, if you will. And Bazaar Voice is one of those companies that has done that and has really profited, and collectively they are very influential in the same way that a Consumer Reports and people we're going to read something and then they're going to say, you know, buy it now or get best prices, that sort of thing, like Price Grabber.
Mm-hmm.
That's a whole avenue of influence. So whenever someone asks me who's influential, I say, okay, let's go through the categories. So that's one. Now, out here in the Valley, it's a big deal about who's in line to get a deal and how did they get the deal and that sort of thing. A lot of the VC bloggers are influential. I don't think anyone has ever really taken over the mantle of Red Herring, what Red Herring...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, Red Herring was. You'd need to be seen in there if you wanted to be on the good side. Now, VentureBeat was designing itself to be the inheritor of influence in deal-making, but we all know what happened to the business. There's no such thing as an IPO anymore. So
right.
VentureBeat had to reposition, and now there's sort of a loose confederation of mini titles like games and so forth. So that's another area is sort of insider. I think what's happening in general, to finish this thing on influence, is that in the older generation, there were generalists who developed beat expertise or domain expertise, and they worked for titles that served that segment. Like, for example, there were venture capital savvy journalists that wrote for Red Herring or even the New York Times or Wall Street Journal and covered that beat. But now, in the era of social media, you don't really need to depend on those people to find out what's going on, because the VCs themselves, like Fred Wilson and Jurvetson, all these people are blogging. They're not giving away their best thoughts, but they're branding themselves. So you don't
mm-hmm.
need to go to a generic fact gathering. You just go to the people.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or hang out in a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tony Perkins's thing, I forget the name of it, and work with them, or go on Facebook or LinkedIn or something like that and talk to them. So it's put huge pressure on the brands, on the media brands who are used to hiring generalists to go get smart about a beat. And it's a broken model. I think that model is, if it's not dead, it's wounded.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the broadcast folks suffer for it, and, you know, people that depend a lot on television for advice about these things, that's why people, you know, there's a certain segment of people who say, oh, yeah, I just found out about Twitter a couple months ago, you know, whenever Oprah started watching it, and it was the top story in one of my Ad Age emails that, you know, she's gotten to a million users or followers already, so, you know, as following goes, that's great. But what it really means to the business will be interesting to see if it means anything. But it certainly means attention. So that, I think, is important for, you know, for our clients, and, you know, for them to understand why people are talking about it is important too. One thing I wanted to ask about is kind of a side note that's sort of come up a little bit, but, you know, it used to be that blog networks were a big thing. I mean, Glam Media, to talk about, you know, totally different industry. But the beauty industry, you know, a lot of people were competing in that space, and they decided to, you know, basically get a few A-level bloggers on board with specific points of view that were known for those points of view, and then get B-levels that were kind of competing to grab their fire and energy about competing for the top slot, build this network, and they made a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we've sort of seen that with some of, so, you know, in terms of blog networks, how have blog networks, so, you know, in a sense, taking bloggers that have their own shingle and combining their collective voices into a network that, you know, obviously the idea is to take the collective bargaining power and use it for advertising purposes.
Mm-hmm.
How has that played out in terms of the business and technology press?
It hasn't played out with as dramatic effect as it has in consumer. The advertising business has benefited from ad networks, sort of unsurprisingly, because they're sensitive about advertising and leverage and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But fashion and beauty, I guess that's the same segment, advertising has benefited well. When you think about the tech networks, I still think that there's still a star system that has affected both advertisers as well as readers. They still, the brands in tech are in some cases 30 years old or more, and then there are sort of newer brands like CNET, news.com is 50
mm-hmm.
years old. That's old in internet time, but
yeah,
it is publishing. So therefore, people needing to go to, let's say, the IDG Tech Network or Federated Media or something like that to find out who the new voices are. Everything is so viral in the tech business, in my experience, and everybody is so gossipy in this business that you know, you can pretty much find out without too much effort who the new darling is. And the ad networks on the edit side, I don't think have the clout. Now they certainly do for the bloggers themselves. Like people like in the mobile technology space, JK on the Run. I was following that blog for a long time. They just focused on mobile tech, just a couple of guys. They were funny
mm-hmm.
and had a following. They did a podcast once a week, and they were really cool. And then O'Malik identified them and brought them in, and then Om did a deal with IDG. So now JK on the Run's making some money, and they're even better than they used to be because they are doing nothing but editorial. They don't have to worry about anything else.
Hmm.
So that's about as close as I can get to saying, you know, how ad networks have benefited the edit side of tech. I don't, from my experience, I think that a lot of people in the business haven't needed an ad network as a vehicle to introduce them to new things. I think that everything's so viral and gossipy that people sort of do find out who the hot people are. And there's also tech meme, too. If you really work that's pretty easy to find the titles that are on the way up, and a lot of people use that.
Yeah, I mean, people swear by it. I think it's interesting how they've tried to translate that to Twitter, and I wonder about whether people realize that it's a different product really on pushed out on Twitter than it is to actually go to the site. I don't know if you find that to be true as well, but I think that it is.
Yeah, there's still a lot of fog around Twitter, and in my mind and other people's minds, I've heard. The thing that I notice is that I think a lot of the journalists use it purely as distribution for either what they've just written or some promotional thing. And I would like to see journalists use that tool a little bit more as to humanize them and as a relationship-building device. Now, many do, but not enough.
Anybody come to mind that you think is doing a good job of humanizing themselves?
Denise Dubey at Network World. Brad Stone from the New York Times has potential to do it. He doesn't do it enough, but he's working on it. He avoided it for the longest time, but he's sort of warming up. I think a lot of the journalists are still trying to figure out just what role it plays. And the conservative path seems to be just using it to generate circulation and page views, and that's sort of tacky if that's all you're doing. I think, you know, Chris Brogan had a formula that he espouses that I think works very well for all professionals, not just journalists. And, you know, for every 10 tweets, you know, maybe 6 ought to be germane to the business that you're in. Could be a link pointing to some place or something's happening. But it's sort of a domain expertise thing. And then maybe 3 out of 10 tweets, more or less, ought to be conversational, picking up on something that someone else said and participating 50-50 with other people instead of being the wise oracle that you are as a journalist, and everybody should listen to you. And you don't have to listen to anybody because you work in journalism. And then maybe 1 in 10 ought to be, I'm making Jell-O, or I'm at a stoplight, or, hey, I just saw a blue jay, or something like that. I mean, what journalists typically would call just vanity posts. But I think a little bit of that is important to humanize people. So I thought Chris Brogan's 6-3-1 formula is a pretty good one. And so I sort of use that as a sort of a yardstick to look at people's Twitter personalities in journalism and see how they measure up.
Yeah, we're constantly, as the editor of our Twitter stream at Eastwick, it's interesting, you know, trying to get those pieces of humanity in that seem appropriate. Because one thing we used to do is we used to have, an intern or somebody, you know, like an associate or somebody that had some time would gather the, you know, big information from the day, the big hits from the day amongst our clients and send that out. So I would tweet that. And then there was one in particular that I thought was really clever when I first started here who would talk about, you know, trying to find a decent apartment in San Francisco and that sort of thing. So I would always make sure that once a day I included whatever, you know, I talked to her about it first to make sure it was okay that, you know, I referred to her as Kristen the intern because her name was Kristen. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so Kristen the intern had a presence every day. And I swear I never got more replies than when we had Kristen. And unfortunately, that was the last of it because now our clients are Twittering for themselves. So we're less a distribution channel in that sense. And we're more, you know, we've moved more to the conversation space where we're retweeting, you know, our clients' own messages, but also looking for things of interest to tweet out. So, you know, again, I think that's, you know, I love Chris Brogan. I read everything, hopefully, that he creates. And he's a nice guy to know as well because he'll always include you in the things that, in places where he feels like you can be valuable. So I think, you know, I love that humanitarian aspect of him. If you meet him as a person, he's just the nicest man. But in any event, I think that, you know, that's a great point because I think people forget, you know, they complain about Twitter in the sense that, you know, people are talking about traffic or something like that. But I have at least 3 or 4 stories about using my personal Twitter feed to find out that their Dumbarton Bridge has an overturned vehicle on it. And so I find out about it right before I leave work, and I don't take the Dumbarton, I use the San Mateo Bridge. You know, so there's, you know, for me, it's, you know, if you're using it truly as a two-way channel, you're hopefully getting some value back out of it. And I think, you know, all of us in business, for the business channels, need to figure out a way to humanize, which is why I let people know that I'm the editor of our Twitter stream, and I recommend that to our clients so they have some sort of way of you know, if they feel like they need to come to me to tell me something, they can do that. You know, that's totally transparent. So anyway, that's my little soapbox about Twitter, because I agree with you on that point, and I think it can't be said enough. But one of the things that, you know, I will be killed by the staff here if I don't ask you is, what advice do you have for tech companies wanting to get business press?
Understand those story types. Understand, if you want to, like, go for the long bomb and get a an 800-word or 1,000-word piece, then I would understand very carefully those sorts of story types that are repeated all the time. We mentioned two in the call earlier, the can they do it story and
mm-hmm.
the individualist story. But there are others. There's the multi-case study. There's the counterintuitive take, where everybody thinks such and such is the case. It's actually the opposite. You can make that case. And we don't have time to get into all of them.
No.
That's what I would do. I would
understand
the patterns.
So what do you do if, so, you know, thinking of examples that have happened in the past and present, you know, in terms of trying to get certain companies into the business press, tech companies, that, you know, we in fact may really think deserve the press and go, why is this company getting covered? And maybe not even in the same space, but this whole idea of you're a mid-cap company seems to be, that seems to be one of the qualifying factors. And, you know, I mean, one of the benefits of going to Columbia Journalism School and paying all the money is that you get on the listserv. So sometimes I'll go on there and I'll say, you know, why can't we get, you know, press when we are chatting with you and, you know, they want it, one of the first questions is, what size are they? Or, you know, they know the size based on the company name. What do you do to get around that? Because I feel like that's, you know, kind of a gating factor right now.
That's interesting to hear. I hadn't heard that. Certainly a company that's publicly traded has a little bit of an advantage. But what I've seen in the modern world, 2008-2009, is that the stories that they will make time for are stories that you could get a call to action out of from a reader. A reader would write an email or go into the boss or retweet or take some sort of action that, and it would impact their status quo, their view of what the norm is. And that sounds a little broad, but let me try to be a little bit more specific. Sometimes, for example, if you can pitch a story that maps the collision of two sorts of technologies. Now, you know, I don't know what you have, if you have an iPhone or what, but that's a collision of computing and communications, and it has transformed the way that we live and work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You probably have that in your pocket or your purse or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Metaphorically, the successful business story embodies that collision, that mini collision, where two well-understood things that everybody knows have bumped into each other, or there's full head-on collision, and the aftermath of that is in doubt. What does that really mean? eBay is another example of everybody understands sort of what auctions are and so forth, but and when that collided with computing and all that stuff, there was something new happened. Value was created, new winners and losers were created, and there were broad impacts. And those are the stories that make the cut, even today, where you can map two or more factors that people sort of understand, conventional wisdom, and those two or more things are going to interact in a new way, either based on business activity like a merger or a new skill set is evolving or there's some collision, and what the impact of that collision is unclear, but it will have some measure of importance to the point where a reader will say, "Geez, I got to get on this. This might be happening under my nose here, and I never even realized it." So it works in advertising. Call to action. That's what it's all about.
That's true.
But when it comes
and
to
we
edit,
talk about it on websites all the time. I'm like, what do you want the users to do when they come to your homepage? Yeah, it's something that you know, I've definitely introduced as sort of the, you know, a social media element, because you're looking for your users to hopefully do something viral, you know, in most cases, that
work
helps.
Back from that. So work back from that. So you finish your pitch. What are the outcomes? What are the calls to action that would produce outcomes that people would take action on? That they what would they tell the boss? What would they tell the boss? What would they tell their friends?
That's very good. I'm going to think about that, Sam. We're out of time, unfortunately. Want to thank everybody. Thank you, Sam, for being with us and tuning in. Those who have tuned in to Break Through the Noise with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Our next week's guest is Peter Shankman. Do I need to say where he's from? He's from Help a Reporter Out, among many other things. And that's 1 week from today. You can check blogs.eastwick.com for times and where you need to click. As always, you can keep up with the latest on this show and Eastwick in general at blogs.eastwick.com. Have a fabulous weekend.